Well, it's good morning, David. How are you doing?
Good morning. Doing well, thank you. How are you?
I am doing pretty good, except these allergies just
killing
me right now. I went to the Southeast Oklahoma last week.
Uh-huh.
Off air, and so many trees down there, and I was just like, no, just make it stop.
Yeah, the warmer weather's great, but it does bring with it allergy season.
Very much does, and got back up here, and I thought it would stop, but nope. It's still us. Still got kind of a runny nose. It's not a cold, believe me. So, or anything else that could be, you know, considered horrible. So
anyway,
yeah.
And for whatever reason, apparently I hit the program 2 button off. Anyway, we're fine. That has nothing to do with on air. We're good on
Alrighty,
air.
Good
it's
deal.
Just I got to fix the record here in just a little bit. But anyway, David, you coming on today here for Greenside Up. We'll have somebody else in later with you today. But
yeah.
You want to talk about a couple of upcoming events, correct?
Yeah, so we'll start off by some upcoming events we have. The first one is a dicamba training and tile drainage discussion that will be on March 19th at the KSU Southeast Research and Extension Center in Parsons. They're on Ness Road. It will start at 10 and go to 1:30. It will start off by an in-person dicamba training. The dicamba training is something that farmers need every year if they plan on applying dicamba. And then it will finish up with a producer panel of discussing local tile drainage and their experience with it. It is free of charge and lunch is included. They ask that you do RSVP by calling the Girard Extension office at 620-724-8233. And then the next event we have coming up, which will be the first Saturday in April, is tractor safety training, which any 14 to 15-year-olds who are wanting to work off of their family farm this summer, they need to have taken tractor safety training, but it is open to all ages of youth. So that will start at 8 a.m. and go until about 2 p.m., and it will be at the Extension office in Independence. The cost is $10, and that will include the book that the kids need and lunch. And we ask that if you're able to RSVP by March 27th, and you can call the Independence Extension office at 620-331-2690 to RSVP, and also if you have any questions. And then a couple other events that are coming up that we just found out the dates on, and these are through the area office, so they're for the whole southeast area of Kansas, is the Spring Crops Field Day, which will be Wednesday, May 13th. Topics that they'll be discussing are hard and soft wheat. They'll have an economist there, Mark Nelson. They'll also be talking about soil fertility and then finishing the day off with a tour of the wheat variety trials at the research station there. And then there will also be a cover crops field day on Wednesday, April 22nd. This will be near Bartlett, and topics discussed there will be using cover crops for weed control, grazing cover crops, soil health, and then it will finish up with a tour of cover crops.
So, wow, just a ton of events you guys got lined up.
Yeah.
So a lot of events to participate in, though, and a lot of good events, especially since we're starting to get close to spring. It'll be the time of year.
So it'll be a busy time of year.
Yeah, it's the busy time of year. So lots of workshops. And also stepping into studio, just want to say good morning to our Wendy Powell. Good morning, Wendy.
Hello.
It's good to see you today. So, you guys got quite a bit to talk about, so we'll get back to you, David, right now. And the first thing you wanted to talk about this morning was voles.
Yeah, I thought I would talk a little bit this morning about voles and just what they are and a little bit about their population dynamics. And then if we have time, we can also get into different control methods, because I have had quite a few people mention voles in the last couple weeks. So for those that don't know, voles with a V are small mammals that live throughout Kansas. They're sometimes referred to as meadow mice. Voles are compact rodents with short tails, stocky bodies, big heads, and short legs. Their eyes are small and ears partially hidden. They are usually brown or gray, but their color can vary. There are three species of moles in Kansas. These are the woodland vole, meadow vole, and prairie vole. Voles are small, weighing 1 to 2 ounces as adults, and their overall length varies from 3 to 5.5 inches for the woodland vole to about 4.5 to 7 inches for the meadow and prairie voles. Voles play an important role in the food chain as they provide a major part of the diet for many predators, including coyotes, hawks, owls, foxes, and snakes. The mortality rate for voles is high, with their life expectancy in the wild often not exceeding 2 months, and few live longer than 16 months, so they don't have a very long lifespan. But voles are prolific animals. The breeding season for all voles is most of the year, although it peaks in the spring and fall. Meadow and prairie voles normally have 5 to 10 litters a year, so almost a litter per month, and their average litter size is 3 to 5 young. Woodland voles are not as prolific. They only average about 1 to 6 litters a year, and their litter size is 2 to 4 young. And then a little bit more about their population dynamics. Large population fluctuations are characteristics of voles. Population peaks occur about every 3 to 4 years. These are not regular cycles and don't usually involve spectacular population explosions. Occasionally, populations will increase for about a year before declining again, and several factors contribute to the population growth. Voles do not hibernate, so this is one reason why I've probably been getting more questions about them lately. They weren't hibernating in the cold weather. Females become reproductively active at a young age, about 35 to 40 days old. Voles can give birth to a litter of 3 to 6 young every 21 days after the young of the first litter are weaned. If the habitat provides protection from predators and high-protein food sources exist, populations can reach very high levels in a short time. Vegetation higher than 6 inches, snow cover, brush piles, leaves, and low-hanging limbs all provide great habitat and protection for them from predators. If there is good cover and high-quality food available during the population growth period, predators can't keep up and economic damage can occur. So a little bit about the food voles eat. Voles eat a variety of plants, including grasses, legumes, and crops. In horticulture, plantings such as flower and shrub orchards and lawn and gardens, voles can cause damage by eating flower buds, clipping grass items, girdling stems of woody plants, and gnawing roots. So most of the time when I get questions about them, it's related to the damage they're doing in someone's lawn or garden, because of course that's very noticeable and it messes up the beautiful lawn right. People have in their front house. So in late summer and fall, voles often store seeds, bulbs, and rhizomes. In the winter, they may gnaw on stems and bark, causing significant damage to ornamental and orchard plantings. Plants not directly killed may be more susceptible to disease or die from drought stress caused by the damage that they do. And voles do tend to live in colonies. A vole colony may have several den openings connected by a network of underground runways. So a lot of times people will also notice the little holes they make in their yard and wonder what those are. The wrens of the meadow and prairie vole are on the soil surface and lead to underground dens, while the runways of the woodland vole are usually underground. Vole colonies consist of a pair of animals, but more than likely will include several generations. A colony can have runways covering an area as large as a quarter acre. Voles are sometimes found in large numbers under landscape fabric and mulch piles near ornamental or woody vegetation. And if you do notice damage on your lawn or garden or trees, damage identification caused by voles or signs are found mostly above ground, such as trails in the grass and grass clippings, and feces at the base of large clumps of grass. surface runways at ground level usually lead to entrance holes, which are about 1.5 inch in diameter. Girdling of trees at ground level will reveal paired grooves left by chisel-like teeth. Girdling completely around the tree trunk will kill the tree, so any indication of above-ground damage is cause for a control program and concern. Rabbits, of course, also chew on trees, but the girdling begins several inches above the soil surface. Rabbits have a much larger incisor teeth than voles, which will be reflected in the size of the grooves of the girdled trees. Rabbit damage can be controlled with a plastic tree guard, but these devices will not prevent damage from prairie or meadow voles. Voles do not commonly invade homes and should not be confused with the house mouse. House mice are smaller in size than voles. They have larger ears and a longer tail. Their tail is about 3 to 4 inches long. So now a little bit about controlling vole damage if you notice damage caused by voles. Before initiating a vole control program, be sure to consider the extent of the problems in relation to the cost of control. Damage prevention is much more beneficial than population control after the damage has occurred. An integrated pest management strategy that includes a combination of prevention and control methods should be implemented for controlling damage caused by voles. So we'll start off by a few cultural techniques. Cultural practices such as mowing, using herbicides to control competing vegetation, and frequent tillage can reduce the dense ground cover that serves as vole habitat. Although mulching with sawdust or wood chips is an important practice for many ornamental plantings, this practice also provides excellent habitat for voles. Good sanitation in the garden, orchard, or lawn also is essential. Remove unused garden crops and clear all fruit from the orchard floor. Piles of dead branches and brush should be burned, chipped, or hauled away to eliminate rodent habitat. Anything that removes or reduces vegetative cover helps make the area suitable for voles. A 4-foot diameter vegetation-free area around the base of young trees or vines will reduce problems. And then, of course, there's also exclusion. Young trees can sometimes be protected by placing cylinders made from hardware cloth mesh around the stems. Hardware cloth should be buried at least 6 inches deep to keep voles from burrowing under the wire cylinder and leave about 12 inches above the ground to reduce potential damage. Voles can climb well and sometimes forage on top of the snow, and thus a fence may need to be taller than 12 inches. However, these exclusion techniques are not always practical, nor will they protect the plant in all situations. So if you've tried the techniques just listed and it's still not working, you're still having some problems, you can also trap the voles. And this is effective for small numbers of voles and is often the most practical and economical method to use around the home and in the lawn and garden area. A snap-type mouse trap used with a small piece of apple or peanut butter on it works well for bait. To improve trap success, you can bend a shingle to form an arched roof over the trap so the trap spring arm will clear the shingle. To trap pine voles in the deeper tunnel runs, some excavation will be needed to place the trap down on the run. Place the trap at a right angle to the run. Prairie and meadow voles can be caught by setting traps at right angles to their runways or back-to-back with the run. No excavation is needed because these species travel along surface runways and don't skimp on the number of traps. More, it increases your likelihood of being able to catch them. 10 traps would be the minimum number to use in a yard or small garden. To reduce opportunities for disease transfer, of course, remember to wear plastic or rubber gloves when handling the voles that have been caught in the traps.
Yes, and also remember where you put those traps, so you don't actually set one off on your own.
Definitely, yeah.
You step
keep
on
track of where you put them, so you can check them later
or something. So, because I did have a family member do that before. They stepped on a mousetrap. Yeah, didn't feel very good. So, all right. So, just a few questions here. You say voles are about the size of mice, though. That's why mice traps are good. So.
Yeah, so they're small. They are about the size of mice, so that's why mouse traps will work good for them. And there's a couple other ways that you can trap them if the mouse traps don't work. But of course, mouse traps are easy to get. You can pick them up at Walmart or the grocery store next time you're there. So that's the easiest option to start with. And then if they're outsmarting the mouse traps, we can go from there.
And for somebody who may be just joining in, what are kind of the differing characteristics between, say, a mouse and a vole?
So voles are a little smaller and they have really small ears. So probably the easiest way to tell the difference is that mice will have larger ears and a longer tail than voles will.
Okay, so they're burrowing type animals. They go underground, like you said. They have runways. They also have surface runways. Just kind of look out for, you know, damage to your lawn on the surface runways, going, you know, back and forth, and little as you said, grass clippings, and to kind of just kind of keep it a lookout for that. You may have some visitors there,
right? And a lot of times when people notice them in their lawn or garden, they notice the holes they're leaving in the. Especially with lawns, they notice that first before they notice any real damage. And then also for anyone who's just joining us, voles do not go in your house. So if you notice any small critters in your house, that's definitely a mice or rat.
Right.
Voles will stay outside.
Yeah, they don't want to go inside. They don't want to go. They don't want to go where the people are.
Yes.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Wendy Powell about a lot of different things. You are listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. Good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. Kyle High back in studio with you, and back in studio with us from the K-State Extension offices, we have Wendy Powell and David Skrantz. Ladies, how are you doing this morning?
Great. How about you?
Good.
Doing good. It's good to have you back here today. And it's now time for the second part of our show, Green Side Up. And Wendy, we wanted to talk to you. And for people maybe who were not here for the first part of the show at 7:40, there are a couple of trainings going on, including dicamba training and hazardous occupational training.
Yeah. So we're going to be having a dicamba training. And at the end of that, there will be a segment on tile drainage in Southeast Kansas. So that's going to happen on March 19th at the KSU Southeast Research and Extension Center. That's going to be located on Ness Road, Highway 400, location in Parsons, Kansas, so not far. And if you're interested in attending that, I think there is going to be a lunch, so we need RSVPs to the Crawford County Extension Office. That phone number is 620-724-8233. And then we've got our hazardous occupations training, tractor safety, coming up on April 4th. So this safety training is for 14 and 15-year-olds. It's open to a lot of different teenagers. But for 14 and 15-year-olds, it's a state regulation to have this certification to legally operate farm equipment off of the family farm. So if you're considering taking a job this summer off of your family farm, then you'll need this certification. The cost is $10. It does include lunch and the training materials. Saturday, April 4th from 8 to 2 in the Independence Extension office. That's right on Peter Pan Road. So we do need our meal counts and make sure we have enough training material available. So please RSVP by March 27th to the Independence office. That phone number is 620-331-2690.
So those are a couple of... I don't know what happened to my headphones there. They stopped working for a second. So those are a couple of trainings that are workshops that are coming up here pretty soon. Well, Wendy, today you wanted to talk about a few things. And one of the things you wanted to talk about was spring pastures. And with springtime coming up, I know a lot of gardeners that are itching to dig into some soil. Is there anything livestock producers should be considering for pasture management at this time of year?
Yeah, so I think that this time of year just creates some inborn return fondness to producers of any walk of life to just get into the soil. And so, yeah, pasture managers can certainly be having that on their mind, doing some soil tests. This is a great time of year to be doing that. Maybe not in the next couple of days because it's just so wet.
It's a little wet.
Yeah, and it's supposed to rain quite a bit the next couple of days as well. They're talking about rain nearly all next week, so that should be interesting.
Yes. So as soon as it dries out just a little bit and you can pull some samples that aren't full of mud and create that extra shipping weight, get those soil samples sent off to the lab. Any of the K-State Extension offices can help you get those sent to the lab. All four of the Wildcat Extension offices in the area, Independence, Fredonia, Altamont, and Girard, all have soil probes that folks can check out, take to their pasture, pull the soil samples, and then whenever you are submitting your samples to the lab, you can just bring that probe back and we can get you all hooked up. So what that analysis does for you is take a look at the nutrients that are already in your soil, so your phosphorus, potassium, and if you wanted to take a little deeper look, we can even look at organic matter, zinc, all of those micronutrients that could be limiting to your pasture growth. So anytime you're growing anything, you want to make for sure that it has the nutrients that it needs to really thrive. Not all pastures need fertilizer, but how are we supposed to know if it needs it or not if we don't pull a soil sample? So those are only $10. I really encourage anybody to pull those. It's easy. If you have questions about that, give me a call at any of the extension offices and we can get you hooked up. A lot of different weeds plagued our pastures last year, so timely weed ID is very important for control options. So I've had several people call me this week and last week with some questions about weeds that they had last year. Well, this really isn't the best time of year to be identifying problems from last year because all that's in the pasture right now is either the skeleton or a pile of mush that's really hard to ID. So whenever you're seeing that stuff come up and you have questions, if you can give us a call to come out and take a look, that's really the best option. Or if you can take some high quality photos and get them to us, I can help you get some IDs. And if I don't know what it is, then we'll ask a higher power and get an identification for you. Because whenever you are wanting to control something, knowing what it is going to be your best line of attack to know what to either spray or use a cultural control option, like simply pulling them from that landscape to, if you've got a small amount of plants. A lot of times with thistles, I would encourage folks just to dig those up. If you don't have a huge population of them in their pasture, I would just encourage you to dig those individual plants up rather than trying to use an herbicide. It's a much more effective way to kill thistle, for one thing, but it's also going to be less economic and environmental impact. Right now, we're also seeing, well, maybe not this week with all of the rain, but this time of year, we might be seeing some insects moving into alfalfa stands. This will be a good time a year to keep an eye on that. So scout your pastures, scout your hay meadows. Make sure that you don't have weevils or aphids. Keep an eye on things like that. So anytime that pastures have additional stresses, rather than just temperature, things like flooding is an additional stress, aphids can really take hold. So keep an eye on that. Anytime you're wanting to take care of native grass, prescribed burning, and David, you might want to hit on this a little bit later if you have questions. Pasture burning is really a great option to take care of native grass stands because it is nature's way of controlling weeds and making sure that those stands are healthy for animals to consume high quality forage. So let's talk about safety when prescribed burning, because that's really what a lot of folks worry about. And there's a lot of measures that you can put into place to make for sure that your burn is safe. First of all, of course, you want to talk to your neighbors and make for sure that that's something that they're going to be on board with. But you can also install fire breaks, things you can plow just a few feet of soil around your pasture or mow it like with a brush hog or even a lawn mower to make sure that you have a nice fire break that's going to stop a fire. And if you do that fire break a week or so before your fire, you'll want to go back out and double check them. Use a leaf blower, blow off any leaves that have gone into that area. You'll also want to make for sure you have a thorough burn plan in place. So we have lots of resources at the Extension office for creating a burn plan. Also, NRCS can help you with this. And you'll just really write a prescription for your pasture. And so it's a prescribed burn. Write a prescription for your pasture. Take a look at where your water breaks are. Anytime you have heavier, denser stands than in other places, you can kind of choose which direction to send the head fire, line out where you're going to light your back fires, all these different measures that you can take a look at before you actually go out and start the fire are really going to help you at the end of the day make for sure that you have a safe and productive fire. I mean, the whole reason you're doing this is to take care of the land, and so you want to make for sure it's productive. So you want to really take a look at what you're dealing with and make for sure it's effective.
And just adding on real quick with that, along with making a prescribed burn plan, also an important part of that is making sure the weather conditions are right for the day you're going to burn, making sure the wind isn't too high or that there's enough wind, and also that the humidity level is right. And as you're writing your prescribed burn plan, like Wendy mentioned, we can help you with that. And NRCS also has resources, and we can also show you the National Weather Service, their website, and how you can use it to double check the weather conditions for the day you're planning on burning.
Because you're kind of have low winds, obviously, but also kind of higher humidity. That way it does have a chance to get out of control, basically.
Yeah, it does vary a little bit depending on what you're planning on burning and your specific burn plan, but it is a balancing act between the wind, because you do want just a little bit of wind and you want enough humidity, but you don't want that humidity to be too high where then you have problems getting the fire started, right, and conducting the burn.
Right. So anytime that you're thinking about doing that and you have questions, just give a Davin a call or myself or NRCS. They can certainly help you with those things. A couple of other thoughts that I had on pasture management. This is a great time of year to be doing fertilizer plans. And I touched on soil samples a second ago. Those samples are only $10, and that really gets you a great analysis of the nutrients that you have. But what do we do with that whenever we get the results back? So I can help you determine your fertilizer rate. So depending on what sort of fertilizer that you're wanting to use, and we can customize these to your operation, then I can tell you exactly how much urea, DAP, or potash you might need, or poultry litter if that's what you're going to use, different things like that. So really, your $10 gets you a really excellent product to take care of your pastures.
Just a question, you were talking about last year there were a lot of weeds in fields last year. Was it because of the amount of rain that was received last year, or was it just, was that one of the reasons that caused it?
Yeah, so last year with all of the rain, we had a lot of growth on a lot of different kind of plants, and certainly weather conditions will play a role in what species will come up. But we do every year, there's lots of different weeds that show up that you might not know, and you just want to take a look at. And sometimes if there's just one or two, you know, and they're not doing much there, it's not a big deal. It's when there gets to be a lot per square foot or a lot per square acreage that we reach the economic threshold that they need to be controlled. So some plants, that's one plant. So like Sericea lespediza, if you see one, you better take care of it immediately. But things like henbit, you know, that we're seeing right now, that purple flower that's coming on right now, it's really not a huge economic impact in our area. So it really just depends on the plant.
Okay. And something else you did want to talk about was safety dealing with newborn animals. There have been a lot of newborns in the past month, and they'll keep coming for a while. Are there some safety precautions that producers should keep in mind when working with freshly born animals?
Yeah, so safety should always be at the forefront of every producer's mind in any situation. But whenever you're dealing with new mamas of any species, they're going to be a little bit more on edge to protect that newborn. That's an inborn trait that they have, and that's how we have survived as long as we have on the earth. So even if you know the animal's general disposition, realize that whenever she has a baby and there's young on the line, that disposition is very likely to change. So keep that in mind whenever you might be getting close to the animal, if you're checking them, or even if you think maybe she's getting ready to have her baby, not really sure. And then just be wary whenever you're doing your pasture checks. There's lots of different things that you can do to make for sure that that is going to be safe for you.
And what sort of injuries can occur in these situations for newborns and the mamas as well?
Well, most often we see trampling. The producer will be out checking animals, and the mama will just try to run them over to get them away from their baby. Sometimes we'll see biting in the cases of like horses, depending on like if they're stalled, or pigs if they're stalled, things like that. So animals are going to do a lot of different things to protect their babies. And so we just have to be wary of those situations. Being ran over is probably the most common, though.
And I do remember I had a cat when I was younger, and her disposition did change after she had had some kittens. Mm-hmm. She was just like, don't get near me. Stay away from the babies. And she would move them around. It was so funny because she was an indoor cat, and she loosened up after, you know, the kittens were able to start walking on their own. She kind of went back the way she was. But when they were just little things that couldn't move around themselves, she was like moving them around all the time. Mm-hmm. She's like, don't get near my babies, even though we were trying to help her. But of course, that's like you said, that's that. It kicks in. It's the basically kind of, like I said, it's kind of like the mama gene. She's mm-hmm. being very protective of her young. Why would a producer want to get close to a newborn, though?
Well, there's a few reasons. So production records are what comes to my mind first. So a lot of times producers will want to record the gender, of the newborn, the color, the day that it was born on. Of course, you don't have to get close to the animal to record the date. But in order to record some of those finer details like the gender, the color, things like that, you might need to get closer. And producers sometimes want to go ahead and put a temporary ID in them, or a more permanent ID, like an ear tag, so that later on, whenever there's lots of different similar looking babies in a pasture, like if you have 10 solid black calves bouncing around, it's pretty hard to, to tell them apart. Or, you know, 15 different little black-headed Suffolks. It's pretty difficult to tell them apart. So a lot of producers will go ahead and stick an ear tag in those ears. That way, they can match that baby up to the mama. If some reason they were to get separated, they can identify those animals fairly quickly. And that also helps later on at weaning time and a lot of different stages of production there. Another reason that you might want to get close to them is just to give a vaccination. So with hogs, they need an iron shot fairly quickly after birth, just to make sure that they can thrive. So that's something. There's a lot of different equipment that farrowing sows use, but in some operations those are not available, and so producers need to get close to those babies, and the sow might be available to get them. So vaccinations are another reason that a producer might want to get close.
And lastly, are there any is there any equipment that is helpful in these situations to basically get close to the newborns?
Yeah, so what comes to mind first is going to be like farrowing crates. A lot of different larger hog operations will have sow barns that will utilize safety measures like this to you know, precipitate all of these challenges, but also to make for sure that production is at its most efficient. But if you're working just in a regular barn or in other indoor facilities, make for sure that you've got good lights. So you don't want that light to be shining directly into the animal's eyes, of course, but you do want it to be well lit enough that the animal can see you approaching. Make for sure that you just announce yourself. That way you don't startle the animal, especially horses. They can get pretty skittish. Another good tip would be to wear good footwear. Right now, especially this time of year, we're dealing with a lot of mud. So if you're out in a pasture and you're looking for babies, make sure that you are wearing something that's not going to slip off. If you have to take a few steps backwards, you want to make for sure that your shoes are going to be there whenever you take a step backwards, because it's not fun whenever you your shoe doesn't go with you.
No, it's not.
You take a step and it just sticks in the mud and you keep going. You're like, oh, okay, I need to step back and get that boot back on because it just slipped right off because the deep mud that's going on right there. So one more question, and this one's for both of y'all. If anybody has any questions that they would like to ask of you guys, how can they get a hold of you?
I'm at the Altamont Extension office. That phone number is 620-784-5337.
And I'm at the Independence office. That phone number is 620-331-2690.
All right, ladies. Well, thank you so much for coming in today, giving us a lot of great information. And we appreciate you guys, all the work you do. And thank you very much again for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
All right. We're going to go ahead and take a break. When we come back, we'll start Open Line. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF.